This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Spalding Gray, has turned his life into theater, performing monologues, often very funny ones, about his personal and professional adventures. Whatever the subject, the real subject is usually Gray's neuroses and obsessions about illness, death, and the difficulty of letting go and enjoying himself. Those of us who've been following him over the years confront a new Spalding Gray in his latest book and monologue, Morning, Noon, and Night. Spalding Gray, who has spent his adult life focusing on his art, living in a Manhattan loft when he wasn't wandering the world, is now the father in a nuclear family on Long Island. He moved there in his mid-50s with his new significant other, Kathy, their young son, Forrest, and Kathy's daughter, Marissa. Shortly after they moved, Kathy surprised Spalding with the news she was pregnant again. His first reaction was to suggest an abortion because he couldn't imagine further complicating his new life with a third child. But he later decided he was too old to choose death, and they had the baby. To appreciate how dramatically his life has changed, you have to know a little about his earlier life. Let's first of all pick up where we left off before we resume your story. I think it was two monologues ago. It ended with your marriage to Renee Shafransky, who also used to direct your performances. Then your monologue right before the new one was called It's a Slippery Slope, and in which you explained that after you got married, you were having an affair, and shortly after you got married, the woman you were having an affair with got pregnant with your baby. Would you pick up the story from there? Take it, Spalding.
And that's a good cue. In other words, I should recap that.
Exactly.
What happens in It's a Slippery Slope.
This is your equivalent.
That's a good and difficult question, because part of me is probably trying to forget that part of my history. And so what happened was there was a very strong reaction all around, and I acted out, and I am not sure to this day whether I had a kind of nervous collapse or I acted the nervous collapse, because I simply couldn't deal with the enormous amount of A, responsibility for a child I thought I didn't want, B, the guilt for the betrayal, certainly, of Renee. If anything, I still feel that was the issue with me, that I would never, that I've learned that lesson, I could never go through that again, that I should have known myself better, been more honest with what was going on. But the secret side of me was needing to be a father, and I was completely, I assure you, unaware of that. So what happened in the break was that Renee got strong enough, got her stuff together to walk out on me. Until some reconciliation. We went into couple counseling, now that I think of it, and I don't think that's in the monologue. And I couldn't come to a clear place about what I wanted. And the therapist said, I don't think we can continue working together. We're in a free fall state, whatever that meant. And it definitely felt like really falling, and I did not know where I was going to hit. And where I ended up hitting was taking the initiative to go and see my son at last when he was 8 months old, and holding him. And that's where I hit. That's where I came down. And some part of me quite clearly realized that this was not going to work with me. With Renee, she had made conditions of me going to therapy, of me being completely monogamous, completely sober, and completely devoted to her, and also only receiving the baby like a football. That's how she envisioned it, that Kathy would open the door and pass Forrest out to me, that I would never see Kathy. And I just knew if Renee was running by those rules, I couldn't answer them to them. And that's... fell quite in love with my son, and then began through him and with him to have a relationship with his mother, who I had only known in a more fantasy affair situation that wasn't grounded in family at all. So it was a complete turnaround, and everything that was supposed to happen in an affair where you're supposed to, you know, break up with your wife or the woman you're with and not be with the woman you're having the affair with but start a whole new life, didn't happen. It was a real surprise, and now we have a second child.
Now, you say in your new book that you never thought that at the age of 56 you'd recreate your original family structure of two adults,
right,
and three children. And I'll add to that, you really always seem like the least likely person to end up being the father in a nuclear family. Up until, I guess, your mid-50s, you had chosen a completely different life, a life of kind of experimental art and New York City loft living and touring the country and, monogamy, well, not monogamy, many partners, plus long-term relationships. So this kind of nuclear family seemed like a very improbable choice
right.
for you. Do you feel like you're...
Side,
yeah, go ahead.
On the other side of that, totally probable, just because the other really ran its course.
Did it? Did you feel like you came to a dead end in the other life?
I only feel that now because I don't miss it. You know, when I crave it, I'm clear that it's a fantasy, a craving fantasy. And when I play the fantasy all the way through, I realize I'm in the best possible place I could be in right now.
So you feel like you're living the life you're supposed to be living, not like you've stumbled
well,
into it, now you'll make the most of it.
I feel that I'm living a life of necessity, which I hadn't felt before. I had never, I can remember saying this recently to my brother, my older brother and his sister-in-law who were visiting us when I picked up Theo, who's 2.5 now in my arms, and I said, here's my anchor, here's my necessity. And I was coming more and more feeling that I had to generate work because I was a monologist and that people were waiting for the next work. And that beyond that and that relationship with Renee was getting more and more thinned out around that work relationship and her being the co-writer and that. And beyond that, I honestly didn't feel necessity. I felt a kind of dabbling, a disconnection, particularly with New York City, too. I really was losing that, and that move out was enormously important for me. And when I talk about It's a Slippery Slope, you know, there's a lot about people sometimes don't see what the parallels, as it were the downhill skiing. And for me, coming into that sport changed my relationship to winter and life and my body. And being outdoors for 7-8 hours at a time like that just brought me into a whole a craving for outdoor activities that I really am immersed in now in Sag Harbor.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say that children led to what you call the double chaos factor. Explain what the mm-hmm. double chaos factor is.
When I lived in New York City with two previous relationships before, two women, Elizabeth LeCompte and Renee Shafransky, in both cases there were no children, but there was a lot of work. We were doing intensive work, and I was also out in the city alone a lot. I would take long walks and be enthralled by what I call the mystical chaos of New York City, that it should not be functioning, but it is. It's functional dysfunction, dysfunctional functionalism. To me, it was total constant theater. And I don't mean that in a cruel, distancing way, but in a way you have to do that with New York to cope with it. And that, of course, leads to irony and all the rest of the diseases. But here I was trouncing around New York, getting big hits of it. And then I would come home to the two women that were centering and calming me and nurturing me. And so, in a way, I was the child in that relationship. Once there were children in the loft, it was totally chaotic. And also, they weren't acknowledging me in the same way. And Kathy didn't have the same energy to totally aim at me. You know, if I'd come home from tour, I described this in It's a Slippery Slope. The chaos. Forrest was up on my desk naked. Marissa's running around singing her life in opera. And they notice me, but they don't go, oh, sit down. Can I pour you a beer? Was it hard out on the road, honey? So all of that changed, you see. And I needed to get to a place that was where I could walk outdoors and there'd be some peace.
So the double chaos factor is that there's chaos on the streets and then there's mm-hmm. chaos at home, too.
Yeah.
Well, do you feel like you've had to become less dependent in a way? Because like you said, in some ways you were the child in the relationship expecting a lot of attention and nurturing from the woman in your life. But when you're a father and the woman in your life is a mother, a lot of that nurturing really has to go to the kid. So has that...
Well, I'm growing up. And it's really amazing to be growing up at almost 60, but... I mean, an example of that would be that Kathy has a talent agency and she handles solo performers. And she was out booking at a booking conference this Wednesday to Sunday in Kansas City. So I was with the children. Now, we have a babysitter that spells me in the afternoon, but I'm dealing with getting them off in the morning and getting them down at night. And the storm came, we had the hurricane watch that didn't really hit, and I have this little sailboat, you know, that I just love, a little beetle cat, a 15-foot day sailor that had to be taken out because of the storm, and then they didn't put it back in the next day. And I was saying to Kathy, but I wanted to go sailing today, and she goes, you're whining. And I thought, she's right. And I said, but what I need to hear from you is, oh, it's really, really rough. I'm sorry I left you. You're such a little pookies. And you, I'm just sorry the children. What she says instead is, you are so lucky to have such wonderful children. And I've covered you with the babysitter. And, you know, the underlying that is, as in, remember, grow up.
You always seem to need a lot of nurturing. Do you feel comfortable in the role of kind of being the nurturer as the father?
I do, yeah, because it's such a surprise that it's like a new part of me blossomed. So it's a dimension there. And I like it so much that I get nervous as Forrest grows. Forrest will be 7 on Monday, and he's much more independent. So then I need to see Theo being dependent on me so that I can still have that nurturing force going. And Theo is a less dependent child than Forrest was. It's interesting to see that. But I don't want to lose that. You know, I don't want to have it taken away from me by their independence.
My guest is Spalding Gray. His new book and monologue are called Morning, Noon, and Night. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Spalding Gray. His new book and monologue are called Morning, Noon, and Night. As you point out, your prior relationships with women didn't include children. And in your long-term relationships, the creative act was, you know, the focus of your attention was art, not family and children. Now that you have 3 children in the house, is it hard for you to work? Is it hard for you to focus?
Yeah, that's a big issue now, and I think about it a lot. I'm thinking about it more than I'm doing it. Morning, Noon, and Night was the perfect monologue for me being at home a lot because it was a way of organizing that chaos. And now that it's finished, I don't want to go into an update or an ongoing thing of this. I mean, I don't want to turn the family into a Nazi and Harriet situation or an ongoing sitcom. And why don't I want to? I mean, because part of me thinks that would be really easy to do. And the responsible part of me says that I would like the children to become more themselves than minor celebrities, major people rather than minor celebrities. And I think too much of that, of turning them into characters, is ultimately going to be deadly. So a part of me says it's time to give myself an assignment, you know, to look at something else that is relative to the community but not right in the family, so they don't have to travel, say, to Burma. And there are things that loom their heads, and then I say, well, I have to go out and really look at these things and pay attention to them. Then I go like this, and I said this to my sister-in-law recently, it feels so much like homework. And she goes, but it is homework, Spalding. And then I realized that that's what my problem was. I could never do homework or assignments. So I'm floundering now, and I'm in a space right now where I'm not working. I'm keeping my journals, and I'm reading a lot. I'm, you know, cross-reading, and I'm paying attention. But I don't know what the focus is now, on what the new work is. It's far, far from my scope.
You say in Morning, Noon, and Night that you used to never be interested in the real world. You were more interested in creating your own world through theater. Mm-hmm. And now you're very much in the real world in the sense that a lot of your time is spent taking care of kids. You're home a lot more than I think you've probably ever been in your life. Is mm-hmm. that fair to say?
Yeah.
Has the real world become more interesting? Do you find that there's a way to have both, you know, to have the theater world, the art world, and the real world in your life at the same time?
Well, for me, ultimately, the theater world became what was happening outside of the theater in New York City. So it was the issue of the street. I also tell a funny anecdote about that, about Forrest and I going to see the David Copperfield show and going up on the subway from Soho up in West Broadway and Soho up to all the things that happened on the way to 42nd Street. And I say, when I get there, the David Copperfield show, well, it was good, but compared to the show out there, it is a rival. And so what I find, how theater began to spread outside of the theaters for me, and I got less and less interested in going in to see what I call acting. You know, you walk in, with the exception perhaps of Death of a Salesman, which I thought was the embodiment of the role, this new production of it. I walk in and you see people acting on stage. And I go, why are they acting? I mean, life already feels distant enough and feels almost like an act. So I began to see theater as all around me, and now certainly the family is the ultimate theater. If you can, when you can, in a good way, aesthetically step outside and really appreciate the children's performance and then even appreciate your interaction with them. At its best, it is rocking theater.
It sounds very distancing to me to see your family as theater.
I know it does. And people are going to react to that in the pejorative, I'm sure. And critics already have. When I say one of my favorite things to do is I describe our house, our 1890s house, as looking like a doll's house because there's these French doors down below. And I say at night, I sometimes on stormy nights want to run outside to get distance on the family and see the children playing in this doll's house in front of the fireplace and the mother on the other side of the wall cooking and cleaning. And that is, I remember, I think it was a San Francisco critic that said, Gray is still distant, you know. I mean, what else is a writer? I'm not going to change that way. But I'm in and out of it. You know, I am in there are times when, when the family's really rocking, it's like being on a sinking ship this morning, getting them off of school and getting into the city. On that bus from Sag Harbor was just like a scene out of the Titanic. And that's not theater then. I mean, someone else's theater.
You know, now when you're talking about your life, you're also talking about your whole family's lives.
Yeah.
Including your kids. And here's something I'm wondering about. You know, you explain in your monologues that your first son was born when you weren't even having a relationship with his mother, and then you got together again afterwards. Your second son, you at first opted for abortion, but then changed your mind. This is the kind of thing that parents often like never want their children to find out about.
Right.
And of course, I mean, this is like on the public record now. So I wonder how you feel about that, about your kids knowing this kind of stuff that outside of your art, you might not have wanted to tell them.
A couple of things, three things I think about. One is I've noticed that throughout the interview, you've been using the word explain. And I wish that I was doing that. I feel that I'm telling, I'm reporting and not explaining. And the other was that I remember when Renee and I were still talking around and after the breakup, and we were having dialogues and having lunches together, and she said, I just can't wait. Till, because she says, when your son is a teenager, when Forrest grows up and sees your monologues published and sees the early dedications to Renee, and he's going to go, okay, I want to find out who that Renee is. And I thought, my God, Renee doesn't know me. After 14 years of living together and working together, she would think that I would, like, not do a monologue about this. Of course, at the time, I also thought it was impossible to do that. I think it's really, really good to get it out there and to pay attention, to really pay attention to his, in case Forrest's reactions. He saw Morning, Noon, and Night. He's a little bit aware of Slippery Slope, but he sat through the whole production of Morning, Noon, and Night. And afterwards, slowly things surface and there's a dialogue. But I'm very, very careful. And I think this is the only way you can go at it, is that you keep him, and I really don't know how to do this as he gets closer to being a teenager, but keep him conscious. You know, keep a dialogue going where I would answer the question by, you know, saying, this is how Daddy works, this is what I do, and this is, you know, hey, would you rather not be here?
Right.
It's not a bad life, Forrest. It is not a bad life.
And then daddy's a drama queen.
This is how Daddy makes a living for us. Now, do you want me to do something else? Because we'll be living in quite a different situation. Are you ready to give up the big house and move into an outhouse?
You know, there's something I have to confess as somebody who's like followed your work for so long now. I mean, since the 70s.
Right.
By the time you're telling your audience about something, it's happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
Right? But to me, it's brand new. So I'm reading the stuff about, you know, Spalding Gray and, you know, nuclear family and everything. I'm thinking, oh, it's never going to last. He's not that kind of person. And of course, you've been living this life for years and years already.
Right.
It's just
that
it's new to me.
You know, that's a really good point that the audience doesn't realize that. It's really a hypnotic event because I'm a good enough actor to act. You know, I'm now at a place now where I've created the material. The creative part of me has now made the material. Now I have to act it fresh as though it just happened. And that is what's happening. So that when people see Theo backstage or around the theater, if he's there with Kathy, they think it's Forrest. And they just can't put it all together. That was during Slippery Slope, once now that I talk about Theo and Forrest and Marissa. But as a friend of mine once said, the audience thinks they're just turning the corner with you and you're already down the road. Or, it really is a very kind of weird and skizzy situation that I have to watch out for, too, lest I think that the monologue is the reality, because we're into just a whole other family dynamic now that requires a completely different response from me. And so to go off and do the monologue is refreshing in a way, in the sense of showing an old family album or something. But it's also not, ultimately, it won't be vital. The acting is what is vital and what saves it and makes it a good show. But ultimately, it won't be vital for me because I will then have to move on and figure out what I'm thinking about by talking about it. And that's how the new monologue comes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you again.
Spalding Gray's new book and monologue are called Morning, Noon, and Night. He opens at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater November 7th and takes the monologue on the road in February. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.